This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's a well-funded suburban high school in the Midwest that has an issue. It's racially diverse, but once classes begin, the sessions are anything but integrated, and school officials can't figure out why.
The question for them, and particularly for this one assistant principal who called us in, is how can this be in a place where a liberal district, we have a lot of resources, all the people I work with have very good intentions, and how come I'm about to retire and I'm seeing the same thing that I saw 30 years ago?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from one of the researchers called in to explain and help solve the racial achievement gap at Riverview High. We'll also spend an academic minute exploring the quality of your boredom. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Riverview High School is a comprehensive high school in the suburbs of a large Midwestern city. It is a fairly affluent area, so it's well-funded. It's also racially diverse, with equal numbers of black and white students. So why did the retiring assistant principal of the school call researchers to find out why the students were segregated along racial lines as soon as they went off to class? That's the topic of the book, Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools, which was written by Dr. Amanda Lewis and Dr. John Diamond, two of the researchers who took on the project. Here to talk about Riverview, the book, and the racial achievement gap they found is Dr. Amanda Lewis, director of the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at the University of Illinois Chicago. I started by asking Dr. Lewis just what is the racial achievement gap?
The racial achievement gap captures a pattern that we've been seeing in school outcome data for at least several decades, and it reflects the fact that if we look at national test score data, if we look at GPA data, a whole bunch of different measures, we see persistent gaps between the performance outcomes for white students and black and Latino students.
And is this all ages?
All ages,
yes. All levels.
It changes somewhat over time. There's a small gap when kids come into school that gets bigger by the time they finish.
And let's talk about Riverview. This is a school that reached out and looked for some help, and they thought they were doing everything right.
Well, I think they had a contradiction going on. They thought they were doing a lot of right things. It was a high-performing school. It was a school that had won a lot of awards. But it also is a school that when you walk into the building, into a school that's about 40%+ white, roughly 40%+ black, and the rest a small Latino population, when you go into the building, even though there's a bunch of kids in the hallway, when they start heading off to class, they're heading off in different directions. So, for instance, the high-track classes, which are honors and AP classes, are predominantly white, and the regular, quote-unquote, classes are predominantly African-American. And the question for them, and particularly for this one assistant principal who called us in, is how can this be in a place where a liberal district, we have a lot of resources, all the people I work with, or at least most of the people I work with, have very good intentions, and how come I'm about to retire and I'm seeing the same thing that I saw 30 years ago?
And they had a budget that most schools would die for.
Yeah, it's a budget that's not unlike a lot of well-resourced suburban communities, but it absolutely is a budget that most urban schools would die for. Resources were not the challenge in the school.
So when the research began on this school, what were your goals? What were you looking for?
Part of what John and I were trying to do is engage about what's going on. And the common sense tends to go along one of two lines. One line is to say that if black students are not doing as well in school, it's because they have a kind of oppositional culture to school. And by that, people mean that they discourage each other from achieving. They kind of think school is either a white thing and reject it because it's for white people, or they reject it because they just in general are negative about dominant institutions. There's lots of ways lots of forms that has taken, but that kind of theory about what's going on permeates popular cultures. So that's one set of theories. Another set of theories says that part of what's going on is that black families are just not as invested in school. It's the opposite of the tiger mom theory, right? The idea that if parents were more invested, if they cared more, if they pushed harder, the kids would do well. And even though there was not a lot of research support for either of those theories, we felt like we had to look at those at least in part, to make sure that that wasn't what was going on. And very quickly it became clear that neither of those were true. In fact, Black students and parents at the school are as invested in education as everybody else. They're working as hard, and they're trying to be successful. So we ended up not just interviewing Black students, as the assistant principal had initially wanted us to do, but really interviewing white students and their parents, Latino students and their parents, teachers, administrators, secretaries, school safety officers, school board members, trying to get a full sense of the community, how it functions, and understand as much as possible why even in 2005, 2010, 2015, do we see places like Riverview where the kind of patterns within the school look kind of old-fashioned in many ways, you know, with kids really not integrated within classes themselves.
You had a quote in the book saying that they pretty much reproduced segregation once they walked inside the school door.
Yeah. And it's one of those things when you first walk in the building, it's kind of shocking, right? So the first time I visited the school separate from this study, I walked into an AP and honors class, and it looked really different than what I had just seen in the hallway. And I walked into a regular class, and it looked really different than what I had just seen in the hallway. And one of the things that we want to understand is, how does, over time, this even become natural so that people are well-meaning, good people walking in and out of a building every day with a set of practices or patterns going on in the school that feel, you know, like it's 1954 again? And we aren't outraged about that all the time. What are the stories we tell about that that make that seem natural or make that seem the way things should be? And then the other big question was, what's going on in the schools that contributes to this? What are the things that schools could be doing differently to try to change these patterns?
Is this brought about by the culture of the school or the culture of the people coming into the school?
Well, we do think that culture matters, but not in the way people typically sense it matters or think that it matters. What we think is that in many ways, kind of wider cultural belief systems penetrate inside schools in a way that shouldn't surprise us. So we have lots of, you know, some people think about them as stereotypes, some people talk about them as racial narratives, racial scripts in our culture, but they're ideas that tell us in a way that we don't even have to think about. They're kind of common sense. Oh, you know, some people are smarter than other people. Some people like to dance more than other people. There's a whole set of those kinds of ideas that have a long history in our culture and emerged partly, some may even say hundreds of years ago, but that emerged at a time when we required justifications for really deep inequalities in our culture. And those ideas still exist. And so when psychologists talk about race as one of these kind of primary categories, when we see somebody, we automatically categorize them, right? We give them a gender, we give them a race. And when we do that, it's not a neutral process. We are also carrying with us all those kind of cultural beliefs that manage to penetrate and shape the kind of interactions we have. So we argue both that we need to monitor those things very carefully, because one of the things that end up doing is we have teachers, without meaning to, often have different performance expectations for some kids than others. And those different performance expectations have implications on a kind of moment-by-moment basis. They kind of build up over time. They seem small moments, but when they're repeated over and over and over again, they have consequences. But there's also structural challenges within schools about the way that we organize schools. So even today, tracking in schools, you know, the kind of placing of some kids in high tracks and other kids in low tracks is something that really exacerbates these kind of patterns and over time actually makes things worse.
It sounds like the teachers and the administration, they had the best of intentions. It's just the reality didn't turn out quite that way.
Absolutely. And the challenges are both, in some ways, I mean, the other thing that we talk about in the book is why, given the best intentions, or why, given that some of the teachers and administrators we talked to even knew that there were problems, why don't they change? Why don't they just get rid of tracking, for instance, if they know that this is something that's exacerbating challenges without necessarily having huge educational benefits? And one of the problems is, one of the things they face is that some parents in the school, a lot of kids are actually benefiting from the way things are organized right now. So many white upper middle class and middle class parents in schools like Riverview really push against changing the way things are organized because their kids end up in the best classes. They have the best teachers. They're in honors AP classes. They're doing very well. They're going to the best colleges. And the way things are organized right now works for them very well. So when we think about these kind of racial patterns and outcomes, we often look at the people who are at the bottom and say, well, why aren't they doing better? But, you know, we say we also need to look at the people who are at the top and look at the way that they're benefiting from the way things are organized and what kind of actions they're taking to try to keep things the way they are, even if they often do it in kind of seemingly race-neutral ways, right? They don't say, oh, I want my kids in the white class. What they say is, you know, my kids need to be challenged, my kid needs to be in the top class, and you can't change the way things are because it's going to dumb down the, you know, there's lots of resistance to any kind of change.
Did they come up with mixed ability classes in Riverview, and how did that work out for them?
They did do some of that, and they're part of, I think, a movement of a lot of schools nationally beginning to do more and more of that. I mean, one of the things that we know about tracking from decades of research, not ours, lots of people's, is that heterogeneous classes, when they're well done, are good for everybody. And when we do the kind of separating into high and low, what happens is that all kids who are placed in the high track classes, independent of where they started, do much better, partly because of higher expectations, because they get best teachers, because they get better resources and that sort of thing. And it actually widens gaps. So rather than saying, oh, kids are short on skills, we're going to flood resources into the lower track classes to catch them up, that, of course, unfortunately, is not how these things work. Riverview has made, and I'm not going to say name specific programs that they're attending because it would make it too hard to identify the school, but they are making efforts to try to basically level up, increase the educational experiences, the quality, the challenge, the expectations for all kids in the school. They are dealing with a lot of resistance. So one of the things that happened early on that we talk about in the book is they tried to make the sophomore social studies classes all mixed level. And have them organized by topic so that, you know, kids could be in a class and it would be a mix of regular and honors. And then, you know, if you wanted to be in the honors, you could just do a few more assignments, do a little bit of extra work, that sort of thing. And they would organize them topically in sort of area studies. And one of the things that they found is what they call the kind of interior white flight, so that people would sort of, again, self-segregate themselves into certain topical areas, partly because they felt like certain areas would be either address their kids more, or they would use lots of kind of racial code words around who they wanted their kids in class with. So again, you know, there's like, it's two steps forward, one step back. But the school is working, trying to ameliorate these things, trying to, in fact, live their values and their practices, trying to mediate the kind of challenges that come up in the community when they do that.
Still to come, our conversation with Amanda Lewis continues with a look at how class and economics fit into the picture. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Amanda Lewis, director of the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We're talking about her new book, Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. We've been focusing on what she calls the racial achievement gap at Riverview, a well-funded Midwest high school. How much does economics have to do with this? And not the economics of the school, because obviously that's fine, but the economics of the people coming into the school. There's a story in the book when they talk about the PTA meeting in the palatial home, and it just some of the lower economic people probably wouldn't feel comfortable walking down that block.
Yeah, absolutely. Class matters, and we talk a lot about the fact that absolutely people's socioeconomic resources matter a lot for educational performance. I mean, one of the biggest predictors of your SAT scores is your class status, right? We don't argue with that at all. But part of the reason we looked at these questions in Riverview is because it's not your typical, when we think about racial achievement gaps nationally, we often think about, you know, majority-minority urban school districts that are underfunded as compared to predominantly white suburban districts that have a lot of money. And there's like race and class, and they get conflated and they overlap in a lot of ways. But in Riverview, we have a much more solidly middle, upper middle class, black population. There are some working class black families in the school, but they're very solidly working class. There's, you know, the poverty rates are pretty low. And so it gives us a chance to see how race matters above and beyond kind of class differences. Of course, class still matters in that we know that when we compare black and white middle class families, they don't have exactly the same resources, right? There's still large wealth gaps between families, and their experiences in school are not the same. So research by Annette Laurel and lots of other folks who've focused specifically, you know, controlled for class, as we like to say, we see that parents often engage in similar behaviors, you know, in terms of trying to advocate for their kid and push their kids in, you know, the same direction and make sure they have lots of activities and make sure they're top classes. But the kind of constraints that they face and the kind of resistance that they face from school is quite different. So class absolutely matters. The kids in the school have more resources, are doing better and have advantages in terms of the kind of tutoring they can get, the kind of resources they have in their home, how much flexibility their parents have, the kind of cultural capital even their parents can deploy on their kids' behalf. But race matters in a kind of way above and beyond that. One of the interesting things that John and I found is class is often hard to read among kids, especially when they're walking up and down the hallways. Everybody's wearing the same jeans. Everybody's wearing the same, you know, backpacks, whatever's popular at day. And one of the things that happens in a kind of subtle measure is that race becomes the thing that people read to read class, because it's much more obvious. So one of the kind of subtle things that happen, and when we talk to teachers, we sort of found this a lot, is they presumed, no matter what their actual class status was, that the white kids in the school were middle or even upper middle class. And they, along with that, went a whole set of assumptions about that their parents had certain expectations for them, that they were likely to harass the teacher if the kid wasn't doing well, a whole set of things along with those lines. Whereas the automatic presumption was that black kids were not, that they were more likely to be working class, that they were less likely to have parents at home who were pushing. So there are ways that class really did provide advantages, but they didn't provide the same advantages across racial groups, right? So for us, it was really interesting to try to look at how those things overlapped, to try to pull them apart, to try to look at where the payoff for class was different for different kinds of kids.
Is it fair to expect schools to be good at this when society can't do it outside the school door?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that we talk about is that with the pervasive levels of racial inequality outside of schools, we are going to see some of that inside of schools. It's not fair to expect schools to be able to accomplish something that we haven't been able to figure out anywhere else. On the other hand, it's absolutely true that schools articulate a set of values and really have a set of commitments around educating kids that they could be doing a much better job of realizing. So one of the things that we encourage all schools, including places like Riverview, to do is to say, what are your values? What are your goals? And then let's look at your actual outcomes. And if your outcomes don't match your values, then we need to understand what kinds of policies and practices are making this matter. And so even a minute ago when we were talking about class, one of the things that's class does matter, but in part class matters because of the way that schools respond to kids' resources. So as an example, when we were looking at discipline practices in the school, there was a widespread set of understandings in the school that some kids were much less likely to get in trouble for engaging in the same behavior. And that was partly about their family's resources. Right. So if a family could come in and threaten a lawsuit or, you know, all these kinds of things, that it was going to matter. This shouldn't be a surprise to any of us. We all know that that's true in our criminal justice system in general, but also in schools. Well, part of what we argue is that is a matter of school policy and practice. You either should say, the school should say explicitly, we are going to treat kids whose families have more resources much more gently than other kids, right? Of course, no school is going to do that, or they shouldn't do it, right? So if there's a set of rules that are good rules, that have good consequences attached to them, then they should be mediated the same for all kids. But if it's true that some of the rules are too punitive or that the process that with which we adjudicate the rules is not fair, then they should change for everybody. Right? So there are actually lots of ways that schools could be doing better than they are, even if we don't expect them on a systemic level to be able to ameliorate racial inequality in general. The other reason this is important to me, and I think to me and John in many ways, is because schools often become the explanation for not doing more outside of them, right? We say, oh, you know, yes, there's inequality in society, but every kid has a chance because they go to, you know, public school. We have public schools available to everybody, and that's the reason why we don't need to do other things. So if schools are going to be the reason not to try to address racial inequalities more generally, then schools themselves can't be the thing that makes it worse, right? So you're absolutely right. They can't do everything, but they certainly could be doing much more.
Well, what's the takeaway from all of this? What did you end up telling that school official who reached out originally?
We ended up talking to them and are having ongoing conversations with them and lots of other school districts about the ways that they can do a much better job of aligning their expressed values or even the things that they say they want to be doing with what they're actually doing. And so the upside of the story is that there are a lot of changes that schools can make to do a better job. Some of those changes are painful. Some of those changes will face resistance, and there's some great examples we talk about of districts that have done this well. And some of the resistance you will face is going to be, as I talked about earlier, from families within your school district who feel like the way things are organized is just fine, thank you very much. But another big piece of this is being willing to have kind of courageous conversations about race. It's a hard thing to talk about. People are often nervous talking about it. In our society in general right now, I think people are so caught up with the idea of being colorblind. I don't see race, pink, yellow, blue, purple, doesn't matter to me. But what we have found is that it's only by thinking carefully about all the ways that race does matter that we can begin to think about how to make it matter less. So ignoring it or trying not to talk about it only worsens the problem.
Dr. Amanda Lewis is director of the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at the University of Illinois Chicago. Her new book is called Despite the Best Intentions: How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. Her co-author is Dr. John B. Diamond from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's published by Oxford University Press. Did you know you could be getting bored all wrong? That's not quite the topic of today's Academic Minute, but it's close enough.
There are several ways to be bored. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Tomas Gutz, professor of educational sciences at the University of Constance, presents a previously undefined type of boredom.
We identified a fifth type of tedium, apathetic boredom. We conducted a study in which my colleagues and I differentiated between four types of boredom according to the levels of arousal and how positive or negative boredom is experienced. These were indifferent boredom, calibrating boredom, searching boredom, and reactant boredom. Now we have identified another boredom subtype, namely apathetic boredom, an especially unpleasant form that resembles learned helplessness or depression. It is associated with low arousal levels and high levels of aversion. This boredom type was detected in two real-time experience studies. We found in our study all of the four previously defined boredom types and apathetic boredom as a new and unexpected fifth type. An interesting realization is that people do not just randomly experience the different boredom types over time, but that they tend to experience one type. Further, the results shed new light on discussions about whether boredom has positive or negative effects on learning and achievement. This question can only be adequately answered if we know what type of boredom a student experiences. As for apathetic boredom, which might be assumed being related to depression, we found it alarming that it was reported by 36% of the students sampled. As we have shown, boredom manifests itself through a variety of different archetypes. Our recent findings on apathetic boredom, however, might be the most troubling.
That was Tomas Gutz of the University of Constance. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.